You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 25th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everyone doing?
Good.
Hanging
you sound in there. You sound less sick now, Steve.
You do sound a lot less sick.
I'm like 90% better. I'm not 100% better. I still have a little bit of stuffiness and a little post-nasal drip.
Yeah.
What did you have? The flu?
It was either a bad cold or a mild flu.
Right.
I had the flu vaccine, and some people are getting a mild case of the flu even when they were vaccinated. But there's also just a really bad sinus bug going on. I've had a lot of patients with this where they had a sinus infection lasting for like a couple of months. You know, like just really bad.
Wow.
Yeah. I just have like, it's like I feel fine now. I didn't for a week, but I feel fine now. But every morning that I wake up, there's so much crap in my throat. Mm-hmm. And then once I clear it all out, I'm pretty okay the rest of the day.
I have allergies for me this time of year. Everything's starting to blossom around here in Connecticut, and my allergies are taking off.
Yeah, spring and fall. I have a friend who was supposed to come visit from the Amazon, a friend that I made there, and he can't come because he has leishmaniasis.
Oh, my goodness.
What's leishmaniasis?
It's so common there right now. Everybody's getting it. And so that's when you first get to the lodge, they're like, okay, the number one thing you have to worry about is sandfly bites. Please wear your DEET. Please tuck your shoes, your pants into your boots. It's one of those diseases, Steve, tell me if I'm wrong, where the treatment is kind of worse than the infection.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but yeah,
okay.
It's harsh.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's like a skin infection. And
yikes.
It like itches really bad. But I guess there's another type, or there's a way that you can get it where it spreads like and becomes more systemic, and that's really dangerous. But I think for a lot of people, they get it externally. But they might not know that they have it, so they might not treat it right away, and then that's when things get bad.
You know, I'll tell you something weird that you just reminded me of. When the first time we went to Australia, we landed in Sydney. You guys remember this? And they opened up all the overhead cargo bins, and then the steward walked up and down spraying something into the cargo bins.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because it's an island.
And I'm like, okay, this is probably either some protocol that they have because they don't want something, you know, to cut, you know,
they're delousing us.
Yes, exactly. Or like, then you know, my imagination got the best of me, and I'm just like, you know, what if they know something and they're not telling, you know, like just something weird, you know, like you know that goes. They never told us what it was.
Yes,
they just did it.
I bet you it was an agricultural thing because, I found that New Zealand, even more than Australia, had really strict – like when we went through – I think I might have mentioned this on the show – through the agricultural part of customs, they took out your hiking shoes from your bag and picked individual seeds out of the soles of the shoes.
Oh,
if there was anything stuck to them, they picked it out. Yeah, because they just don't want you know, these non-native species coming in.
A lot of people noticed that the show last week had very heavy breathing sounds.
That was an Easter egg.
Yeah. So, and I don't think anyone guessed what the cause was correctly.
Wait, I think we just got an email that somebody did, this very last email that came in.
Well, a lot of people, no one got it exactly correct. Most people thought it was like, did you change your equipment, your microphone, or that?
Mm-hmm.
None of that's true. And a couple of people thought it might have been in the post-processing, which is true, but nobody guessed specifically what it was. So I'm always looking to see if I can improve the sound quality of the show, and I take all the feedback. And so one of the things that has been bothering me about the quality of the show is the variability in the sound volume of our voices,
mm-hmm.
especially since, you know, we're five different tracks. You know, it's not like we're in a studio. Plus with the microphones – they're not attached to us, right? So if you turn your head to look at your notes, or if you just slightly change the distance between yourself and the microphone, it changes the volume. So there's actually quite a bit.
Not as easy as it sounds, is it?
There's quite a bit of variability in the volume of all of our voices. Now, I level them manually as I edit the show as best as I can, but it's still really hard. And I've been looking over the years, I've been looking for a good leveler. And there's a lot of applications out there. They all suck, right?
They all suck. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like any of them. But the latest version of Adobe Audition that I use for the final post-production has a sound voice leveler in it. So I said, okay, let me try it. So I did, and it worked insofar as it did level all of our voices really well. But then that's what caused the breath noises to be so prominent, because it levels all noises, right? So it raised the volume of the breathing to the volume of all the voices.
Yeah.
Damn our oxygen requirements.
Yeah, I ended up playing with the variables for a couple of hours, you know.
Wish I had giggles.
And including looking up online, all right, how the hell do I fix this? So eventually, I was able to figure out a way to essentially significantly reduce the breath sounds.
Did you have to go in and do it manually?
No. Come on, an hour and 30-minute show.
I know. I've had to edit pieces before where you take them all out. It sucks. Forget it. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the sites I found said, this is how you remove them manually. I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm not going through it. You know, it's just not happening. What I ended up doing was two things. I used a dynamic processor to reduce the low end. So in other words, I reduced the low volume end of the spectrum, which reduces the breath sounds even further. That you could use a volume gate, but that is tricky because if your voice volume ever gets too low, like if you whisper or if you trail off at the end, it'll cut you off.
So
I didn't want to use any hard gate that would clip off the ends of our sentences. And then I just played with the variables in the leveler itself. So I didn't do it as much, and I increased the dynamic range. The dynamic range is the difference between the loudest and the softest noise. That way, by increasing the dynamic range, it levels it less, but it also allows the voice to remain softer, the breathing rather to remain softer, right?
Makes sense.
It doesn't bring it up, you know, because it has a lower minimum in terms of the volume.
And a higher maximum.
After just trial and error, like four or five times, I settled on a process that I thought improved the leveling of our voices, but did not create these crazy breath sounds. But I'll still just, so let me know what you think. You know, if you have, and if, I'm sure there are people out there with a lot more knowledge about this than I have. It's one of those things. It's like computer using, you know. It's a continuum of expertise, and you know, you're somewhere along that continuum, but there's like almost a bottomless pit of expertise beyond what you have at any moment. Audio processing is really complicated, and I've been doing it for 13 years now, but I've only gotten to like a moderate level of understanding, like how to actually do the real technical stuff. You know, I'm usually just like a trained monkey approach where I want to do X. How do I do X? And then I look it up until I figure out how to do X. You know what I mean? And I have some idea like what's going on, but there's like Adobe Audition is like a real professional level audio processor, you know, and it so it has a lot of bells and whistles that are beyond my expertise. So I'm always looking, you know, trying to like, you know, groping around trying to understand what the different processes do. And definitely I get lost in the weeds if I go too far. So, but anyway, and the other thing is over the years I've had lots of audio engineers give me advice on how to improve the show. And 9 times out of 10, their advice is incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, techno-babble. Yeah, do this. Yeah, it's like, they throw all this techno babble at me. I'm like, that really wasn't that helpful.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, if you could walk me through, or they say, the thing is like the bottom line that I've realized is there isn't any simple solutions to any of these things. And at the end of the day, you really can't fix
compromise.
You can't fix bad recordings in post-production. That in a lot of the sources that I read is like, the best way to fix this is to fix your recording, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's only so much you can do.
I
interviewed somebody and they had really bad mic skills, and there were parts that like it was really hard to hear, and I couldn't fix it. And I ended up reaching out before I had an editor on my show. Now Talk Nerdy has an editor, but I used to not. And I finally just reached out to my listeners and was like, hey, does anybody have like post-production experience? Because this one is like inscrutable. And I had multiple people look at it, and they were like, there's only so much you can do when there's literally no data.
Yeah.
And I was like, no.
Mm-hmm. My sound reinforcement experience goes way back to when I was in a band. We were doing live music and you know, some studio stuff, you know, but mostly just messing around with things during band practice. You know, then we got into mixing boards and all that, and I kind of bent that knowledge for the podcast early on. But I've learned more about sound reinforcement while doing podcasting, to be honest with you,
yeah, mm-hmm.
than anything else because of all the different things that we do now. And yep. It is it is difficult and it's complicated. And, you know, again, Steve's so right when it comes to, like, you know, the spectrum from 0 to 100% knowledge. I mean, there's so much to know and so many new pieces of equipment coming out all the time.
Yeah, it's also a moving target. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I've tried to understand the bits that I need to understand, you know, like, and I have increased the post-production that I do on the show to tweak the sound quality. When I do get a good solid piece of advice that is something that I have the time to do, I've incorporated it into my process, and then it usually does improve the audio quality. So bear with us if I occasionally experiment with something and it doesn't work out. We'll fix it.
Yeah, and any time that you feel like something is wrong with the podcast episode, you're like, it's clipping or there's something. If anything happens like that, re-download it. Like, just check again and re-download it, because usually Steve fixes it and uploads it.
Yeah, because, like, I've had to, like, manually email, like, 20 people to say, re-download it, because I did fix it within an hour or two, you know. So, yeah, always try that first, because there may be a better version, especially if you're downloading it, like, on a Monday or Tuesday. Usually I will have fixed it over the weekend.
Yeah.
If it's something that I can easily fix.
Yeah, but the breather episode now is a special episode. If you download it early, you have
kind of like premium content.
The stamp with the airplane printed upside down, that kind of.
Yeah, it doesn't exist special. Online anymore.
That's right. It's special.
All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, what is the word this week? Oh, the word this week was recommended by Julian Goodwin from Sydney. Have you guys heard the word annealing?
Yes.
Annealing. Wow, that was like a throng of yeses there. In what context do you guys know of the word annealing? Because apparently it has a different definition in a lot of different contexts.
It's like some chemistry?
You got some chemistry?
Metallurgy.
Metallurgy. Yeah. Yep, that's a common one.
When you go to church.
When you go, and you're annealing. See, that's the only way I knew it before. I love it. Okay, so annealing
isn't like protein? Can you do it with proteins too?
There's a biology annealing, and a big one is computer science. That's actually the one that Julian recommended, I think, in the email, if I'm remembering back. Sorry,
really?
I don't have it open,
computer
Julian.
Science.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like AI. Annealing is one of those cool words that's got similar but distinct meanings across all these different fields. So let's first talk about biology, because you mentioned that, Steve. To anneal is to make a double-stranded nucleic acid by pairing a single strand with a complementary strand. It can also describe the binding of a DNA probe or a primer, like in PCR, polymerase chain reaction. It also refers to the renaturation of double-stranded nucleic acids after they were separated by thermal denaturation. So if you heat up nucleic acid to the right temperature, the strands will unbind, they'll unpair. And if you can renature it, then they call that annealing. So kind of interesting. Bringing one pair and doubling it up, binding it to its other pair, annealing. Also the binding of the probe or the primer in certain processes like PCR. Okay. All right. So we're getting it. But, like, why is that the same as in metallurgy? This is the one that I think is the most common that people know about. Annealing is also known as tempering. So we all know that word to temper, right? It's toughening it by adding heat and then slowly, I'm sorry, by adding really intense heat and then slowly cooling it back down. And you do that several times in a row. So what happens is the heat brings it up above its recrystallization temperature. It becomes more malleable. It becomes less brittle. The more and more you slow it, I'm sorry. And then when you slow it at the right rate, it actually changes the physical structures of the physical alignment inside the metal. And sometimes it even changes the chemical structure. And the metal itself becomes harder and less likely to break.
Man, whoever discovered that must have been like, holy crap.
I know.
Crap.
Yeah. And apparently you have to do it with glass too. So annealing is also a word that's often used in glass working. They require annealing, and there's a whole special kiln that's used to do it, where it brings it up to a very specific temperature, and then it cools it, like, in a very controlled way. And if you don't anneal glass, apparently it will shatter if, like, heat even minorly fluctuates. And we've all seen that happen with major fluctuations, right? Like, you put a hot dish in the freezer like an idiot and then it shattered. Yeah. So that's what happens if glass hasn't been annealed, even at minor fluctuations. So it's
well,
really
how about
important
this?
To anneal glass.
We've had glass little things in my house that seem to have two of them that seem to have spontaneously shattered.
They might not have been annealed appropriately.
Or we were thinking that there was some sort of a defect in the manufacturer, some sort of some crack or something that at the right moment or something, it just spread catastrophically or something. But it was bizarre. We were like, how does that happen all by itself?
And that's probably how it happened. Probably the AC turned on or it became hot that day. Like there's a temperature fluctuation. Because glass apparently just does that if it's not annealed. It's too weak unless it goes through this process. So that's really cool. And then we've got two more, you guys. Okay, these are really fun. Computer science. In computer science, simulated annealing is a form of optimization, which is simply figuring out how to use less resources more efficiently. It uses the metal and glass analogy. So the definitions came from metal and glass first, and then it was sort of like a metaphor. So I found a quote on a website called MathWorks where they said, at each iteration of the simulated annealing algorithm, a new point is randomly generated. The distance of the new point from the current point, so that's kind of like the cooling, or the extent of the search, is based on a probability distribution with a scale proportional to the temperature. The algorithm accepts all new points that lower the objective, but also, with a certain probability, points that raise the objective. By accepting points that raise it, the algorithm becomes trapped in local minima and is able to explore globally for more possible solutions. An annealing schedule is selected to systematically decrease the temperature as the algorithm proceeds. As the temperature decreases, the algorithm reduces the extent of its search to converge to a minimum. It's like algorithmic annealing, but with code. It's used in AI research. It's used in a lot of applications of big data. But here's a really cool one. There's something called quantum annealing.
Uh-oh. Oh, boy.
It's also known as quantum stochastic optimization. It's a randomized algorithm used in solving really hard optimization problems. It uses quantum behaviors to solve these combinatorial problems at a sort of intersection point between classical computer science and quantum computer science. And everything I read about it, I didn't understand. So if that definition feels thin or insufficient, it's because it is. I apologize. If that's as much as I can say without being wrong. And then the cool thing is, like many of these great science words, it also has a literary use. People often will use the word annealing to talk about strengthening something or hardening something. So you can anneal your perspective on something. I love that. It's so beautiful. So when I looked a little bit up kind of the source of this, it's an old English word actually, which means to set on fire or to incite. And it's got related forms in Germanic, Norse, Swedish, Icelandic, Danish languages. There's a lot of related forms. And again, the PIE, Proto-Indo-European, seems to be related to burning, and it's got similar roots to the word ash. So even though the word anneal and ash are very different, they seem to have similar roots.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have known that.
It's a fun one.
Yeah. Hmm.
I always say it's a fun one. Personally. But I don't think I knew what it meant before,
words are
honestly.
Fun.
Yeah, but still you're scratching the surface on each one of those. Which you said.
Especially on the quantum annealing is like, what?
But even like with metallurgy, there's a whole science to like what happens during each stage of the annealing process and how much heat do you use.
And it's different for different metals.
How big do you let the crystals get and what effect is that on hardness versus ductility and everything. It really is very, very complicated.
Yep.
I have a fascination with metallurgy, so I've looked into it to some extent.
You do. But, do you have specific metals that you're more interested in?
Well, the steel is everything. I mean, it's still
gold. It's like
gold pressed latinum.
Obviously,
steel is still like the most important industrial metal that we have. If you want to make things, hard,
and
it's all in the carbon content. And the alloys and then the annealing process, right? I mean, so that's what affects the properties of the metal. But it partly started because I was trying to figure out if we were going to make a sword with the absolute pinnacle of modern technology.
Oh, yeah.
What would we make it out of? What would be the best sword we could currently make? And I was a little disappointed but also fascinated with the fact that the answer is still steel.
Yeah.
What kind? I mean, what kind, though?
Is there a special alloy that's better?
It depends. It depends. So, this is where then you go down that rabbit hole, right? Like, what's the best steel for a sword? And there, believe, as you might imagine, there's a culture, a subculture of people. Yeah, there are people who that's what they talk about. They talk about what's the best steel for making different kinds of tools, weapons, whatever, and what properties you want to have. The short answer is that spring steel is the best for making weapons. It has to be flexible enough that it's not going to snap, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it be able to hold an edge, and it'd be nice if it didn't rust. Yeah, so there's all different kinds of properties, and you can add different alloys to gain these different properties. And there's a bit of a give and take, you know, in terms of hardness versus springiness, et cetera. And in fact, I think I've actually even spoken to some people who make swords, and they basically buy their steel from certain industrial sources that are used to make like springs, you know, like it's literally called spring steel. And like they'll say, oh yeah, so like I get it from this guy, which makes steel for this particular purpose, like car springs or something, like whatever. So some industrial use, and that steel makes really good weapons, you know. Then of course there are people who are going to like tweak their own alloys or use different alloys for different reasons. But
so Steve, did you like, you guys went to Weta before I went, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you freak out? Was it like the most exciting thing I've ever done?
It was Disney World for special effects. So it was two things. It was amazingly fascinating and frustrating because it's like being forced to run through Disney World and go on only a couple rides. So it's like,
and
wait,
also you can't really touch
and
anything.
We can't talk about it.
Oh, wait, I want to linger. I want to linger here. I want to take pictures. Nope, keep walking. It was just, no, oh my God, I want to go back. Oh, that was amazing. That was amazing. Steve, have you seen the show Forged in Fire?
I've seen Forged in Fire.
Yeah.
I assume you would love that. It's a competition show all about making weapons, making swords, knives, hatchets. It's fascinating.
Yeah. But they get more into the weapon design than the metallurgy, I think, on that show.
Yeah.
Well, you need to visit a foundry sometime or join a foundry and get your metallurgy on.
Yeah, that'd be fun, right?
I went to a foundry once for a TV show, and it was really cool. I got to pour molten metal into a mold and like kind of go through the different stages of how they would cool it by dunking it in all the different liquids and stuff. And it was, I don't know, it's cool to wear the big crazy the big leather apron and those crazy big heat resistant gloves. Felt like a badass.
See, and now we're getting into a new phase of nano metals, right? Where you're actually structuring them at a nano scale, and all new properties are really opening up for that. Like transparent aluminum, right? We talked about that on the show. Mm-hmm. That you can actually make certain metals transparent. So you have essentially something that is transparent like glass, but has the ductility and hardness of a metal.
What does that mean, Steve?
Malleability. Ooh.
What does what mean?
Ductility. Watch Star Trek 4, you'll get it.
It was like you could work it, you know?
Pliable.
Work it.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. It is. It's such a fundamental technology for our civilization, and it's the kind of thing, like, at some point in my life, I knew almost nothing about.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I think what most people know is, yeah, you add carbon to iron to make steel. That was like the extent of my knowledge.
No, I don't think most people know that.
Really? I think that's like one of those things that I always knew because they call it carbon steel. But anyway.
I learned that from online gaming where my dwarf had to make a bunch of stuff and was adding all these components to it. I'm like, oh, that's how you do it. All right.
Yeah, I think only nerds know
add
that.
Add copper here. Okay, cool.
That's right, copper.
Well, like everyone knows that copper and tin make bronze, right?
Yeah. No. Of course.
No, I'm telling you. No, they don't.
You've never won a bronze medal?
I used to know that.
Wah. Yeah, exactly. I knew that once. Sure.
All right, let's move on.
Aw.
So, guys, echo chambers, right? This is something that we talk about a lot. And it is an important phenomenon, but it's not new, but it's a new concern. And it's like, because 10 years ago, as skeptics, we never spoke about echo chambers, but now it's a big deal. There's a couple of studies recently that talk about the online phenomenon of echo chambers, and they actually come to opposite conclusions. So we're going to talk about them. So the question, an echo chamber essentially is the notion that in social media, doesn't have to be social media, but social media and other ways that you consume information, you consume media, that you cocoon yourself into a chamber where you are mostly or only going to hear opinions that agree with what you already believe.
Isn't that called Facebook?
Right. So YouTube and Facebook, for example, have algorithms that will feed you news or feed you videos that are in line with your tastes, with the stuff that you're already consuming. And people have raised concerns that that can have a radicalizing effect, right? So if like, if you watch one video that's on the left or on the right ideologically, or that is about some topic which is common among white nationalists, suddenly you are being fed more and more radical white nationalist videos, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the algorithms actually, if you try to design an algorithm to radicalize people to more extreme opinions, that's what you would do. Mm-hmm. And then also, like we know, if you know, just you make a blog, right? And on your blog, you have, you're writing articles, or several people are writing articles that share some kind of opinion, like you're an anti-vaccine blog. And then you curate news items that are in line with your editorial policy. But more than that, you attract readers and commenters who share your views. And then if somebody doesn't share your views, they're an interloper, they're a troll.
Yeah.
And they and some sites will just outright ban you, right, if you don't agree with the party line.
Yeah.
And so that ensures that people are only discussing, you know, their topic with people who agree with them. And again, that also makes for radicalization. So the question is, how big a problem is online echo chambers? And is this something that's actually getting worse? So one study, which comes from Seth Flaxman and colleagues at Oxford University, he examined the browsing history of 50,000 users. So that's a lot of people. That's one good thing about online research, that it's easy to do thousands and thousands of people, because you can, you know, you could gather a lot of data. And what he found was a little surprising. So first, he found that people are mostly nesting, meaning that they're mostly going to a few preferred sites. And he said, so in terms of consuming news specifically, so that is actually interesting, because that's very similar to what people have always done, right? You would have your newspaper or your magazine or your network that you would go to, and then you would browse for news items in your preferred media outlets, right?
Yeah,
mostly mainstream media outlets. So people are still mostly doing that. They are mostly browsing mainstream media outlets rather than searching for specific content when it comes
to
news.
Or like obscure, like from obscure places. But it's still more laser focused, right, now than it used to be.
What do you mean by that?
You might have read a mainstream newspaper and chosen to go to certain sections, but you're seeing things along the way. You're getting other opinions because it is more mainstream.
No, when you're, but what they're finding is that when you're online, it's still that way. People are still just browsing a few preferred mainstream outlets.
But they're only looking at the article they want to see.
Yeah,
right?
But they're browsing. Mm-hmm. They're browsing, meaning they're not, they're looking at different things.
Oh,
they're not just searching for one specific topic.
Yeah, I was surprised this too, Kara, because my take is, or based on my activity, it's more of like, you know, you see, oh, look at this article, and I just follow the link to where, you know, to wherever it brings me. I'm not really browsing one place.
I used to work at HuffPost, and we would talk about the front page as if that was the front page of a newspaper. Like, if you've ever gone to the front page of HuffPost,
way back
when I was their science correspondent, when they decided they wanted to start a science page. Lots of disclaimers there. We can dig deep into that, but that's, now's not the time. But when I worked there, the team, the promo team and the PR team and all of them used to talk about how the front page, the landing page, really in essence didn't exist. And even though you could go to HuffPost.com and look at the front page, and in the left rail they had the blog posts, and in the right rail they had the trending stories, they had all this layout and, you know, really like the headline, they were like, nobody gets their news by going to HuffPost.com. You have to treat Facebook like it's a front page. That's how they always talked about it. So it's weird that even the media outlets who kind of got it early on didn't fully get it. People are still going there.
I do. I go to front home pages of news outlets and browse. I do that every day.
I get everything.
I do as well. I do.
I get everything from my feed reader or from like curated news on my phone. Everything.
Yeah, I do both. Yeah, I do both. So they also found that there were people, they were in the minority. A minority of people were doing mainly directed searching, the people who were doing more directed searching were going for more radical sites. They were landing on more radical sites, but they were also getting more information from the other side. So they were not only searching for information from sites that already agree with them, they were searching for information and going to sites with information that disagreed with them.
That's surprising as hell.
Yeah. Was that intentional on the part of the searchers, or they just happened to stumble upon?
It's hard to know. the data is not reading their minds, just looking at their behavior. So it's hard to know. But there was a separate now, a 2016 Pew survey of 2,000 users found that only 8% were restricted their browsing to a low diversity of websites. So 92% of people were actually had a fairly high, moderate to high diversity of websites that they were visiting for their news. So those two pieces of data suggest that the problem is not as bad as we may have assumed that it was. That people are browsing more, they are browsing a diversity of sites, and people who are searching equally well for sites that disagree with them as agree with them.
That's so hard for me to understand.
All right, but there's more layers here. There's more layers here. And this is where it gets complicated because it depends on what you're looking at. So then there's a new study. This study reviewed 2.7 billion tweets. So again, lots big data. This is big data, people. These are 2.7 billion tweets between 2009 and 2016, and they concluded that echo chambers are real, but they're looking at it in a different way. And of course, it's also a different platform, Twitter. And you could say maybe on Twitter, there are echo chambers, but on just browsing news sites, there isn't. But what they found is that Twitter users greatly favor political opinions that agree with their own.
Huh.
And they're much more likely to retweet it if it is something that they agree with. And that if you look at people's Twitter networks, it definitely reinforces the echo chamber effect. Now, what they found specifically is that Twitter users, you could divide them into people who were, what did they call it? They're like Nexus users. They're people who have a lot of followers and have a dramatic effect on the flow of tweets, They call them gatekeepers, right? So these gatekeepers have a central role, and those were the people that are searching for content, and they do go to both sides. So that kind of confirms what the other study showed, but they only tweet the side that agrees with them.
They filter out.
They are curating the gatekeepers. That they're getting a diversity of information, but they're curating one-sided information. And then their followers are only getting the one side.
Okay.
Which is it's funny because it's obviously understandable. They're saying, this is my position.
Yeah.
Here's also, a bunch of stuff that supports my position.
Right, exactly. And then, but there were bipartisan users. There were people who tweeted bipartisan news, but they had fewer followers. They get fewer retweets, and they get basically less feedback. So you are rewarded for being one-sided on Twitter, and you are punished for being bipartisan.
And so what were the sides? Is this specifically only highly politicized content?
Yeah, I think they were looking just by politics. Yeah.
Okay. So is this, does this article have a right-wing or left-wing slant?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically.
Right.
Yeah. Or is it libertarian or whatever, but you're right, though. There's so many variables in here, and it's
up to them. They're defining the construct. Because, like, is a standard Washington Post article that talks about something that happened in the White House political? You know what I mean? Just because it's political content, is it written from a political perspective?
What other category would it fall under, though?
But that's what I'm saying. Are they crossing all the ones that they find to be quote-unquote neutral out, or are they saying everything the Washington Post publishes is liberal? Everything the New York Times publishes is liberal. Everything Fox News publishes is conservative. Like, because that would be problematic too.
They looked at specific tweets.
Okay.
And they did take a pretty binary Republican or Democrat kind of approach to it.
A lot of political news that is relatively neutral news.
All of those are good questions. And again, it's like it depends on what model you're using to ask the question, is there echo chambers? Because again, one model looking at how people browse and search says, it's not as bad as you think. But then this model looking at patterns of tweeting says, there's a clear pattern of insulating within a certain ideology. The other thing is, like, you bring up Fox News, that's a TV show. That's not online.
There's Fox.
Is absolutely an echo chamber. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or if you read The Nation, that's an echo chamber in and of itself. So that's why I say the echo chamber phenomenon predates and doesn't is not dependent upon social media or the internet.
That's right.
The internet just adds new layers to it.
And of course, the idea has always been that the flagship publications like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, have at least strived. They haven't always succeeded. And we can see very specific examples of when they've like really publicly failed. But they've at least strived to not have a political bias. Like it's been motivated by their journalistic ethos.
Right.
So, but you know, it's hard because it's all written by people.
That's another dimension that's not even looked at in either of these studies is quality, right?
Yeah.
All right. So here's another angle to this. So there was a study published in March of 2018 that found that Twitter users, again, this one's dealing with Twitter, when they were exposed, that increased exposure to opposing viewpoints actually radicalized them more. That when they did get exposed to the other side, it didn't moderate their views necessarily. So in other words, like a Republican reading a Democratic article comes away thinking, damn, those Democrats are assholes.
Yeah.
Not, oh, they have a point. I should moderate my view. So that's interesting. So that's why I said there's so many complicated layers here. And then the other thing is, the final point is that what's more important perhaps than all of this, than our patterns of searching, our algorithms or whatever, retweets, is our cognitive echo chamber, right? Mm-hmm. Is the cognitive construct that each of us has intellectually. In other words, how do we filter and evaluate all of this information? These studies are looking at how we gather the information, but how do we think about that information is perhaps more important. And this is all the stuff that we talk about, right? This is all critical thinking. Do you try to follow a process of valid logic? And do you try to establish reliable primary sources for your facts? Do you try to look at things objectively? Do you try to truly understand the other side? Do you try to understand the you know all of the valid points you know before coming to a decision? Or are you making a lawyer's case for the one side that you're emotionally invested in? You know, when I wrote about this, an example I gave. Which is a fairly dramatic, and it's very political, but I think this is literally true. If you think about it, we live in a country at the current moment where people are looking at the exact same information and coming to diametrically opposite conclusions.
Sure.
Right.
So, what's a good example of that?
Well, the example I gave was there are people who think at this, you know, one group of people who think that Donald Trump is a semi-literate con artist moron.
Uh-huh.
And at the other end, there are people who look at the exact same data and come to the conclusion that he's a courageous genius who's going to save us. And right. But we're living in the same country, right? We're looking at the same news. We're maybe looking at different people's interpretation of that news.
I don't know if all those people are looking at the same news.
Well, I mean, but the same news and that it's the same events. The same things are happening.
Yeah, but not the same things are reported on. Sometimes, like there are full fabrications that are reported.
That's my point. That's my point. So you're starting with the same facts, the same events, the same things that are happening. Then that's where the echo chambers come in. Then there's different outlets that are reporting them with different spin. They're reporting a different subset of those facts. They're reporting different opinions. And then those are being echo chambered, if you were. And then the ultimate consumers. Who are ultimately looking at the same, you know, the same bit of history are coming to these completely incompatible conclusions, emotionally held, strongly held, you know, very dramatic opinions that are completely at odds with each other. And I'm not saying that they're equivalent, or I'm not making any kind of equivalency argument here. I'm just saying that that's what's happening. There are people. You know, and I had this experience. You could sit down next to somebody and both watch the same program and come to completely different conclusions about what's happening.
Without a doubt.
It's all in the interpretation. That's sort of the internal echo chamber that we all have, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The cognitive one is the most important one. And it's fascinating. That's endlessly fascinating to me. And I think that's a very core critical thinking skill for any skeptic to have is to understand how that can happen and how to keep it from happening inside your own head, right?
But doesn't it make it that much harder for you as a skeptic to watch things that are so obviously slanted? Like, it makes it that much easier for you to recognize when there's, like, terrible spin and to just, shout at the TV.
Oh, I'm grateful that I have some skills in order to parse some of this stuff out. And I'm thankful for what I've learned over the years.
And, yeah. I am, too.
And I feel bad for other people who don't have as much background on these sorts of things.
Absolutely.
As we've been studying all these years.
I see the traps. Now, and it scares me to know that even like 10 years ago, I would have fallen into some of them. And, you know, it's a spectrum. It makes me wonder, like, you know, what do I still not perceive, even after trying to learn this stuff for 30 years now?
Yep. But don't you ever find yourself also seeing things that are so obvious to you that it's hard to imagine that anybody would be trapped by them, yet people are consistently trapped by them?
Yeah,
that makes me feel like I'm out of touch. Sometimes I struggle with that because I'm like –
It's very
so
disappointing.
Obvious.
It's not really surprising, though.
Yeah. It's depressing. It actually kind of bums me out. There are days when I can't watch the news because that aspect of it bums me out.
Oh, Kara, I avoid the news like crazy now because it's so painful. It really is very – it's difficult to absorb. I mean, there's so – how many mornings I can't tell you I'll talk to Steve or I'll talk to Bob, and they're both like, oh, God, did you read the news? You know, it's like, you know, an emotional freak out just from
– It's like it's like having a diet of junk food. You get sick after so much of it. You can't take it anymore.
The spin is really hard to take at times, you know?
Oh, it's so
when
bad.
You're using such blatant bad logic and it's so clearly slanted for the outcome that they want. And it is very, very frustrating. And it's hard. It's hard to find sources where you feel like, all right, this is an honest assessment of what's going on. And absolutely, the more radical extreme you are, the easier it is to build an audience, you know, and if you try to be just objective.
I've seen it happen to a very dear friend of mine where I still to this day wonder if he just had like a massive ideological shift and I don't know when that happened or if he just realized, man, he can make way more money jumping on this train. Mm-hmm. And now it makes me really question, you know, I say friend and I don't even know if that's the case anymore, but it's a bummer to see somebody make a really distinct change in this kind of era of Patreon and of YouTube monetization and all of that so quickly and think, are you doing this because these people are supporting it or do you actually think this way?
Right. But again, in order for the forest to be green, every tree has to be green, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the cumulative effect of all of us as individual consumers making individual decisions.
That's
so
true.
If you want, you know, neutral, high quality, objective reporting that values, again, journalism and quality over ideology and partisanship, then you should reward it. That's what you should reward with your retweets, with your attention. And also with your subscriptions, you know?
Yeah, with your dollars.
You know, we get – at the end of the day, we get the news we deserve, you
and
know?
At a certain point, that requires that you actually read past the headline.
Well, yeah.
You know? That's like
right,
also
Kara.
A big problem.
Yeah, that's a good point. This takes effort.
Uh-huh.
And it's effort that a lot of people just either feel they don't have the time or they just don't have the wherewithal to put into it what they really need to do.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jay, tell us about the 101st solar cell breakthrough this year.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this, one, because it is something that I found interesting. And because of the research I was doing, I filled in some gaps in my understanding of solar panels. So real quick, the efficiency record for commercial solar panels is 26.6%. That might sound a little high. But you were seeing quite a bit of a range here. There's a very large range in what you can buy commercially, but that was the highest number I can find. And that's very good.
That's amazing. Really good. Guys, you remember like when we started doing this podcast,
10%?
it was 12%.
12.
Yeah, 10%, 12%. We were like, oh, are we ever going to break through that 12%? Now it's at 26%. I mean, it's amazing. And that's just incremental advances every year. You know, you get 1% or whatever.
Most people are buying solar panels that are between 15 and 17% efficient. As of December 2014, the world record for solar cell efficiency was at 46%, achieved using a multifunction concentrator solar cells. Those are not available commercially, but that's, you know, in the lab, state of the art, probably with very expensive materials. Typical solar cells are made of crystalline silicon. These are often called conventional or traditional or first generation solar cells. Second generation solar cells use amorphous silicon. This is a non-crystalline form of silicon and are considered environmentally friendly because they do not have any toxic heavy metals such as cadmium or lead. So what is an organic solar cell made out of? Organic electronic materials are constructed from organic carbon-based small molecules or polymers. So researchers at the University of Michigan have developed organic solar cells that can reach a 15% efficiency. This is fantastic news, and I'll tell you why. The average first-generation solar cell currently sold today is 15 to 17% efficiency, like I said. The good news about the organic development is that organic photovoltaics have the potential to lower the cost of a solar energy system. This would put solar collection in the hands of the mass market. Doing the math with a 20-year lifetime, a 15% efficient organic solar cell on average could produce electricity at a cost of less than 7 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the average cost in the U.S. in 2007 was 10.5 cents per kilowatt hour.
That's a nice reduction.
Huge difference, guys. Another amazing innovation here is that organic solar cells are much thinner than their silicon-based counterparts. Now, carbon-based solar cells should be much less expensive to manufacture, and they're thin enough that they can take on the shape of whatever they're attached to. It's also reported that they can be made to have any color, be transparent, and used in clothing, which is amazing.
Wow.
Yes.
Cool.
My last point here, guys, organic solar cells were stuck in the 11 to 12% range, but over the last 2 years, researchers were able to increase that to 15%, and they believe they can get it up to 18% in the very near future.
Oh, cool.
So this is fantastic news. Lots of great facts I think I dropped here. I think I filled in a few holes for myself. I hope I filled in a few holes for you guys.
Yeah, so there's lots of different ways in which solar cells can be incrementally improving, right? So obviously increasing the efficiency, increasing their longevity, decreasing cost of materials in them or the toxicity of those materials. But making them cheaper is huge. That's a huge advance. Even if it's a lateral move in terms of efficiency, it's up in the range of commercial solar cells, but just, dropping that cost. And also what I realized when I put solar cells in my own house is that, I'm able to make 100% of the energy my home moves without even covering my entire roof. So the efficiency is already enough that you can put solar panels on your roof, depending on where you are. I'm in Connecticut. It's not like I'm in Arizona or something. Mm-hmm. Even in a northern latitude, depending on which it really depends on how big your roof is and which way it's facing and also your tree coverage and things like that. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, you could produce 100% of your electricity even with solar cells at the low end of the commercial range. And so you don't really need to make them more efficient. So making them cheaper might actually be even more important than making them more efficient.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree, Steve.
Yeah.
And I had something very exciting happen just today by coincidence. My wife and I were in Home Depot and I saw a Tesla Powerwall in Home Depot.
Neat. I want them so bad. Phil Plate has them. He's been posting about them a lot on Instagram.
Yeah.
I love Phil. That's so cool.
Yeah, I know.
Whoa, how much, Jay?
Oh, they're expensive. I didn't actually see the price.
They're expensive.
They're in the thousands range.
Well, yeah, they have to be that. But I mean, for what you get, I want to say.
Can I charge my phone with it?
But guys, the thing that was remarkable about it was it wasn't big.
What?
It wasn't as huge.
Yeah,
I thought the thing was going to be like the monolith.
Sure, yeah.
Small. Jay, I thought the same thing. Yeah.
They're $6,000.
Yeah.
That's a lot. I don't think the battery technology is quite there yet.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the next generation. But I don't think we could really, even if we wanted to, put one of those batteries in every home because it's the raw material and the disposal and everything and their lifespan.
Also, it doesn't just take one. It takes multiple batteries for most people's houses.
Depending on how big your house is.
Yeah, so, depending on what your needs are. Like, do you have a dishwasher? Do you have a pool? Are you charging an electric car? Like, those things all add to it.
So I think that's a niche application at the moment. And there may be people for whom it makes sense, but I don't think that's like one in every home yet. Whereas I do think we could be putting solar panels on every home. The real limit there is the infrastructure. Is the grid is not really capable of handling that. We need to upgrade our grid so that we can put solar panels on every home. That's actually the big limiting factor at this point in time.
But that's also why I think some people like to add the Powerwall once they have the solar panels, right? That's the whole point, is that then they can actually store the excess electricity they produce.
Yep.
And that's becoming more – it is becoming more important. Here's why. So in Connecticut and in some states, so the power companies are losing money when people go solar because now they're they're either making their own electricity or they're paying the person that they're leasing the panels from rather than that than the power company. Yeah, yeah. And so they're making some of that money back by inventing this new fee where they're charging you for your peak usage.
Oh, great.
And they're saying, oh, well, but that's because we need to have the infrastructure to meet this peak demand. So if you for 1 second a month, your peak demand goes up, then you get paid based upon your peak demand. It's total ripoff,
Wow.
But
those bastards,
you can subvert that game by having a battery to peak shave.
Yeah.
So then you could prevent yourself from ever going, from going into the peak. Yeah. So you could peak shave by using the battery as a backup. And that actually is good for the grid too. Peak shaving is not only good for you, it is good for the grid. But again, I think that we really, really need, and again, we're making these incremental advances in battery technology. We'll get there, but it's lagging in my opinion. It'd be nice, if we can get some cheaper, better, longer lasting, less toxic batteries.
For sure. Yeah. We've got to have a better way to store that energy and access it when we need it.
Yeah, you combine that with solar panels and then we are off to the races. Then it's wunderbar, right? Then
and tell me if I'm wrong, but when you have solar panels, you almost have like the opposite experience of what you were talking about with peak power, because it's better to do all the stuff that most conscientious people try to do at night when you're sleeping. In the middle of the day when it's like hot.
Run your dishwasher, run your washing machine, yeah. All those things.
When most people are doing it, you're trying to prevent it. Exactly.
Right.
That's when the sun's out. Maybe peak hours are probably bimodal, right? It's probably morning and night.
It depends on the season, but peak energy usage does not exactly coincide with peak solar production.
Yeah.
It's usually a little bit later, but it does depend on the season and where
you
are.
And so in a way, that's cool. Because I think that's something that Phil was saying in his Insta. It's like, I got to get used to being like, it's peak sun. Let's run the dishwasher.
But it actually doesn't matter right now. It doesn't matter. As long as you have, as long as you're getting 100% credit for the energy you're putting on the grid, and as long as solar, it has such a small footprint on the grid, it doesn't matter because you're basically using the grid as your battery, and that's fine. Now, but as the percentage of energy that solar produces goes up, eventually we'll get to the point where we are overproducing during solar peak, and then we will have to shift that energy with batteries or something.
Everybody should get an electric car. That's a nice big battery in your garage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, there you go.
Right, as long as your state has good net metering laws, meaning that you get 100% credit for the energy you produce, then you can use the grid as your battery. That's fine. Mm-hmm. You don't need a battery. You don't even need it.
Interesting.
But that will change when solar has enough penetration. Okay, Bob, tell us about this amazing self-cleaning coating you've been raving about.
Kara, you're going to love this one. It's another material science topic.
So, Bob, your goal right now is to convince me why anybody would want this.
Okay. All right. So this time, a materials researcher has developed a new durable, clear, omniphobic coating that can be put on many surfaces and repel almost every liquid there is.
Whoa.
Almost?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not quite omniphobic.
Not 100%.
Mostly potent.
It's omni asterisk phobic.
It's like nearly headless Nick.
This comes from Anish Tuteja and his crew at the University of Michigan. He's a materials researcher who published this in the journal ACS Applied Materials and Interfaces. Tuteja would call himself probably a surface scientist. By the way, that's a study of physics and chemistry that happens when two phases meet, whether it's solid and gas, solid vacuum, which sounds pretty cool, or solid and liquid, of course, as well. And it doesn't have to always include a solid. So yes, this new coating material is omniphobic, and it doesn't mean that it's afraid of everything. But it does, however, shun a lot of things. So to make something like this, you typically need two things. You need a filler and you need a polymer binder. That's pretty much it. So the filler is kind of like the active ingredient, if you will. In this case, it's the repellent material. The binder, that's there to keep the filler together and kind of sticks the whole thing to whatever you're coating. So you really need that filler as well. I mean, the binder. But the individual characteristics of these fillers and binders, it's really not even as important as something else. The most important thing is about the relationship is what's called immiscibility. which means, you know, how well they mix together. So that's a great word. If something is immiscible, which is the form of the word that I've most frequently come across, it means that it doesn't mix. So water and oil are immiscible. But if it's miscible, M-I-S-C, then they mix together well. And you really need that. It's really important. So if you have a binder and a filler that that are really durable and really great, that doesn't really mean much if they're mixing capability. If they're not miscible well, that's a problem, and it could destroy the whole thing. So you could have kind of subpar fillers and binders, but when they mix so well that you end up with a fantastic end product. So that's probably the most important attribute for these chemicals, their miscibility. So how do you develop this kind of stuff? Up till now, or until very recently, it's basically just, you know, you take these chemicals, you mix them together, and you see what happens, you know, kind of the mix and see. And that's pretty hit or miss, right, as you might suspect. And it's also time consuming. What Tutaj's lab did, however, was this. It was really fascinating. They created a huge database of potential binders and fillers and noted all of their properties. That then allowed them to mathematically manipulate them and predict which combinations could produce just the characteristics they're looking for. So I love systematic research like this that minimizes the need for dumb luck. So they could predict, like, all right, here's what we want to produce. Here's the end product that we want to produce. What products can we mix together to get to that end product? And they could come up with 5 or 10 completely different chemicals that they could put together separately and then find out which one of them is actually the best. So using this method, they came up with a mixture of fluorinated polyurethane as a binder and a fluid repellent molecule called FPOS as the filler. So, and of course, it seems obvious that they would work together, right? I mean, well, no, the answer is no, not at all. You never know. But that's what their math predicted. And so this is the best omniphobic liquid repellent on the planet. Nothing. I mean, there's other omniphobic materials out there. This one is the best. It binds strongly to lots of surfaces, and it's a lot easier to apply than those stupid smartphone protectors that you have to kind of put on with a credit card really, really carefully. This stuff, you could spray it on, you could brush it on, you could dip it, you could spin coat, you could do that onto a plethora of surfaces. So this is a lot of different ways to get this on a lot of different surfaces, bottom line. So once it's in place, though, what is it like? It feels like it's like a thin, stiff layer of rubber. I mean, it's polyurethane, right? I mean, it's a thin, stiff layer of rubber, and they say that it should last for a year, which is pretty good. And hopefully they can even make that even longer. But a year is pretty good. So during that time, it won't let any grime get a foothold. Water, oils, alcohols, even peanut butter. How awesome is that? I can't wait until they coat the inside of a peanut butter jar with it.
Okay.
Think about that. I want every last atom of peanut butter out of those jars. Huh. And yes, peanut butter is a fundamental element. You're silly.
PB on the chart.
Uh-huh, yeah, get yeah. it? So predictions are that we could see this in market in seven, no, five, no, two five, years.
Five
two
to
years.
Ten.
I find no. Five, 2 years, they're saying. I find anything under 5 years very encouraging. So when I read that it's 2 years, I'm like, okay, this is a thing. This is probably going to happen. I mean, they have this stuff. I mean, it's not like, look, we have a theory that we could make this. No, they're actually making this stuff. So when the time comes in 2 years, hopefully, we could see anti-graffiti applications, anti-staining, self-cleaning surfaces popping up all over the place. Daycare centers. Oh my God, they're gonna love this stuff. And I think industries, some of our biggest industries are absolutely gonna love this. You know, refrigeration, power generation, oil refining. Think about it. If you deal with liquid condensation in any way, this coating could help shed condensed water and chemicals faster than ever. Some people are predicting that this could increase efficiencies to 20%. Now imagine 20%. When you could do that for an industry that deals with so much volume and so much energy as some of these big industries do, it's an absolute game changer for them. So I really hope that this works out as it seems like it could. Real game changer.
Well, keep track of that one, Bob.
Yes,
keep track of it.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All right. Thanks, Jay. It's Who's That Noisy time.
okay, last week I played this noisy.
Sounds
what
like,
is it?
Sounds like that game Pitfall with other stuff going on in the background.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, it does have a Pitfall sound to it.
Mm.
Anybody else?
I'm clueless otherwise.
It has definitely an electronic sound to it.
I don't know. If you kind of like amplified the sounds of us breathing last week, is that what you did?
Oh, my God. You have to go right to the hospital. lots of guesses this week. I'll spill the beans right now and say there was no winner.
Yeah.
This was a hard one. Very hard. Let me read some of the guesses. Philip Taylor said, sounds like the tape from probably a Commodore 64 or some similar early 1980s computer played in a regular tape recorder. That is not correct, as I said. Mm-hmm. Martin said, greetings from Germany. This sounds very much like an old floppy drive. That's not correct. Someone who put their name in as computer enthusiast. Said, long-time listener, but never guessed before, and I'm a bit far-fetched, but it sounds to me like a record being played in a microwave.
What?
What? Wait, how do you get that to play?
I know, and how do you get the whole record player?
And how do you get the sound out of it?
I don't know. Ev, that these people do it. They do it, Ev. The world's big. Nathan Spawn said, it sounds like an old handheld Space Invaders ripoff I used to play in the 90s, but it also sounds like some kind of racing game on Atari. It does sound like that racing game on Atari. He's right.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Holy crap.
Daryl Thayer wrote this in. He said, you guys probably remember the early days of pocket calculators and maybe even classic Kraftwerk electronic music about pocket calculators. Great stuff, man. Ultra geeky. Well, I happen to remember a chance noisy interaction I had in around 1978 with my high school Texas Instrument T130, or is that a TL30? I think it's a T130.
TI. Yeah.
TI30 calculator.
Texas Instruments.
Yep. I didn't even have it right with my two guesses, Karen. The classic bubble strip LED display type, which taking an electronics course or physics maybe, the interaction was how a running TI-30 calculator emitted gobs of radio frequency noise that can be heard on an AM radio, allowing one to hear computations as they were being performed.
No.
Recently, I came across a classic TI-30 at a thrift store, got it working again, and recreated the noisy with an AM radio just for you and the SGU.
Aww.
So what we hear – I know. I love it. This guy's an engineer. What we hear is most likely a combination of driving the multiplexed LED display, scanning the keyboard, and the calculator chip actually performing calculations. The most interesting calculation, longest to perform and hence coolest sounding, are the transcendental functions, sin, cos, tan, you know those guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cosine, inverses. Tangent, yeah. Like all the triggy stuff.
Yep.
Yes.
Right. This is probably due to the common technique of using lookup tables and or series expansions like Taylor to perform them. Anyway, without further rambling, he's given me the sound file. I just think this is so cool. The guy, you know, recreated this way that people would do this with an AM radio, and he, you know, made sure that the calculator was functioning as well. Really like this noisy. I didn't, you know, who knew that all those calculators that we had back then were transmitting all of this radio frequencies, right?
Yeah.
Oh, the aliens knew. They knew.
So, Daryl, thank you for sending that one in. Very cool. Nobody guessed it.
That's rare, huh?
Yes, it's rare.
Means Daryl wins.
All right, here's the new noisy for this week. That's what we actually sound like before Steve does post-production.
Gosh, I hope not.
So, guys, if you think you know what this noisy is, or you'd like to send me in something cool that you heard, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, guys, well, we have an interesting interview coming up, so let's go to that now. Joining us now is Tobias Fuchsland. Tobias, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Tobias, you are a researcher, and you recently sent me an article that you had published on conspiracy thinking. And I thought, rather than just talking about it, why don't we get you on the show so you could talk about your own study? So tell us about your research and then about the study that you published.
Yeah, so this research project is actually kind of a side project that I'm doing with a colleague. Because in my general research, I work in science communication and look at how people research scientific information on the internet. But we do have a kind of side interest in conspiracy theories. And so we've started being more and more interested in the connection between the way people think about probability and the way they believe in conspiracies.
Yeah, so just reading the abstract of your paper, it sounds like the primary hypothesis is that people will believe in conspiracies more if the probability of the events that they explain are decreased. In other words, they use conspiracies as necessary to prop up a very implausible theory. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's generally the general idea behind this hypothesis is that we more and more see researchers just looking at belief in conspiracies as something that is actually quite common, because we do see a lot of people believe in some kind of conspiracy or have at least the inclination to find them appealing explanations. And so researchers have started to think maybe these are just more general kind of cognitive biases that we see that people have. And we think that one of these biases is this kind of coping mechanism that people have to deal with uncertainty, that they do start to cling on to conspiratorial explanations when they are confronted with a highly improbable event.
So it's a strategy for reducing uncertainty.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That goes along with really, I think, a longstanding notion in psychology that people do not like uncertainty and will attempt to reduce it, even if they have to make stuff up, basically. That we have a fundamental uncomfortableness with not knowing, with being uncertain.
What is also connected to that is that we just generally see that people have a really hard time dealing with probabilities in general. I mean, I could name examples like the gambler's fallacy, the base rate fallacy, the conjunction fallacy, which I'm sure the listeners have heard of before. And research that uses these kind of fallacies with people can clearly show that people just have a tremendously hard time assessing and dealing with probabilities. And of course, improbable events are events that have a low probability. And therefore, we did kind of expect that there would be some biased kind of reactions to being confronted with low probabilities. And that's why we came up with this hypothesis.
Is this the first study that you published on conspiracy theories itself?
Yes, absolutely. And what I would say is that we think it is a highly plausible hypothesis. That is not something extraordinary that we've come up with, not something ingenious. It is actually quite surprising that this has not been looked at before in a systematic way. And therefore, we feel like it was about time that someone just took this hypothesis and looked at it in an empirical way to look whether it holds up to empirical scrutiny. And that's pretty much what we did.
Yeah, so basically you're approaching conspiratorial thinking as a heuristic, as a way of making sense of information.
Absolutely.
And I do think a lot of other researchers nibbled around this idea, even if they didn't directly address the question in the way that you did, which I think is very important in psychology. Obviously, you have to ask the same question 20 different ways before we really get a feel for what the answer is. But there has been research, for example, that says that when trying to communicate to somebody, you can't just take away their existing explanatory model. You have to give them a substitute. You have to give them another explanatory model. So like when confronting conspiracy theorists, it's just the same thing. You can't just tell them their conspiracy is wrong. You have to give them another way to understand the facts. But I think the challenge is we don't always understand the event. Like, we don't know what the answer is. And so they're filling in a gap in many ways.
Yeah, this is also tied to research that also kind of inspired our hypotheses, which pretty much what you just said, Steve, is just that they say that this is kind of similar to what the function that religion serves in society, that it helps people to deal with some really unlikely events where there are a lot of uncertainty, so that you could say that conspiracy theories are some quasi-religious explanatory patterns.
So have you looked into hyperactive agency detection, or HAD? Because I do think that's essentially the same thing that you're looking at. In other words, that's what psychologists call it when people see an agent, you know, that a deliberate action behind events. Mm-hmm. And that, again, that's proposed as a heuristic explanatory model for when we see a pattern in events and then we seek for an explanation for that pattern. Have you heard of that specifically, that term before, hyperactive agency detection?
I have not heard of it in that term, but we did look at some studies that just described it in the way of that people have this need for agency. Yeah. When it comes to these kinds of events. So yeah, I think that's definitely something that also comes into play here.
Yeah, I think if you look up that term, you'll probably find other studies which dovetail with what you're looking at. It does get to the heart of conspiratorial thinking, this notion that there is a hidden agent at work behind events, combined with the tendency that humans have for pattern recognition. In this case, the pattern is not like a visual pattern. It's a pattern among events. And then you combine that with, as you say, we're bad at probability. You know, we have mathematical illiteracy or innumeracy, where we think things are very improbable when in fact they're very probable given the number of possibilities, like given the number of possible details surrounding the JFK assassination. You know, the fact that people can find all kinds of links and apparent connections is actually very statistically predictable, but people think it must be unlikely and therefore deserves a special explanation. Therefore, there must be some agent at work and the whole thing is a conspiracy.
I do think that's definitely true. But what I also think is that this does not fully explain why so many people believe in conspiracy theories, because not everyone looks for all these kinds of tiny details that they can find to confirm their belief in the conspiracy. Most of them just have once heard about the general idea behind the conspiracy, and still they're really prone to believing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that does make it kind of different. And I think here it's just other people that give them these explanations come into play. And I think, yeah, maybe a prime example would be Alex Jones, that in the case of Sandy Hook, he was the one giving people this weird false flag explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And giving them this ulterior motive, really, because in our study, we also looked at that. What is the role of the ulterior motive? And we see that if there is an ulterior motive present, so if we tell people what could be a likely conspiratorial explanation for the event, then they are way more likely to jump on the conspiratorial bandwagon, so to speak.
Yeah, if you provide a motive.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about your other research. So you say that your primary interest is in science communication. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'm doing my PhD in science communication, and there I'm interested in the way people, let's say, deal with scientific information on the internet, because I think there are some instances in people's everyday life where they have some questions where they think, I think science could give me an answer on that. And the question now is, can they find these answers? Because quite likely their science will have some answers for them ready on the internet available, but people need to get through to that information. So it is not that easy. There are quite a few hurdles they have to jump. So they need quite a few skills, and these skill sets is what interests me. I want to look at these skill sets and see how they predict people's success in looking up scientific information on the internet. Unfortunately, I can't really give you any kind of empirical findings yet, because I have just gone past the conceptual stage and am now starting to collect my first empirical data.
So, but you're primarily looking at how the skills people need and use to find scientific information. Yeah. Are you focusing online or just in general?
Yeah, I focus online, and maybe to be a bit more specific, the skill sets that I look at are things like digital literacy, information literacy, but also, of course, scientific literacy, which is supposed to be important when it's about science. And I do also think, of course, that critical thinking plays an essential role here. And I'm actually really looking forward to my first studies, because I do want to compare the different skill sets and see which predictors are most important. And as you might suspect, I do have some kind of suspicion which skills are more important than others. Particularly the critical thinking, I think, could be the key here.
That would be my bias, you know, for doing this as long as I have, is that...
Maybe it's my bias as well, because I've been listening to the skeptics guy for too long.
Yeah, at the end of the day, that if you don't have the critical thinking component, and we actually have been talking about this elsewhere on this episode, because there's a number of recent studies that have to do with that, that, you know, the echo chamber effect, et cetera, like, you know, people do have access to information. Access to information isn't the problem. And I think traditionally we've framed the problem of skepticism as scientific literacy, but I do think in the last 10 years or so, we've really come to understand that it's a combination of scientific literacy and critical thinking skills. And without the critical thinking skills, nothing else really matters, because you can build a case for whatever you want to build and whatever you want to believe in, whether it is a conspiracy or anything else, based upon the information that's out there. So do you think, is it your sense also, so it sounds like you're going to be asking, what's the relationship between these various skill sets and some measure of science communication at the other end? Do you think that science communicators need to be teaching these tools rather than just communicating science itself?
Well, this is a difficult question, because I do think that if science communicators start teaching these skills, then the question is who are they teaching them to? Because I do think these skills should be taught at a very early age. So at a very early level in people's in children's education, I should say. Because I think this is really the stage where you can't do this early enough to teach children about critical thinking and about scientific literacy. And also I think about information literacy, because I do think information literacy does have a role in the sense of that if people are generally savvy as information users in any kind of context, then they will be able to overcome maybe a deficit in scientific literacy. So I do suspect, for example, that the combination of information literacy and critical thinking is the one that you're really looking for.
All right, Tobias, well, thank you so much for joining us. So this is really late your time. What city are you in again?
I'm in Zurich, Switzerland.
In Zurich, yeah. So it's midnight. It's past midnight your time. I appreciate you joining us and sharing your research with the SGU. Definitely keep me up to date on any the results of any future papers that you publish or studies that you do. We'll have you back on the show maybe in a year or two to talk about the results of the research that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Kara, I think you're doing really well this year.
Really?
So far, yeah.
I'm surprised. I'm so noncommittal. Why did you say that, Steve? Are you going to try and get me this week?
I'm just trying to throw you off your game, get inside your head.
There's a theme this week.
The theme this week is shit Kara doesn't know.
It's all material science and black holes. Like, no.
And now here
and
we
original
go.
Star Trek.
Things on the other side of the planet of the Amazon.
Things I pick off myself.
Item number one. A new study finds that untrained 8 to 12-year-old children have the muscular endurance of elite marathon or triathlon athletes. All right, number two. Researchers find that reading an op-ed was more likely to reinforce existing beliefs than to change the reader's mind. And item number three, scientists have demonstrated quantum entanglement in the largest experimental setup to date, 15 micrometers wide, the thickness of a fine human hair. Jay, go first.
So a new study finds that these untrained punk kids, 8 to 12 years old, playing video games, have the muscular endurance of elite marathon or triathlon athletes. So if this is true, that means that, you know, youth and perfect genetics are amazing.
What does it have to do with perfect genetics?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't mean perfect genetics, but I mean, you know, an unaged body and not losing any of its genetic accuracy. Muscular endurance of an elite marathon or triathlon athlete. I could see this being science without even a stretch of the imagination. I could see that one being science. Okay, so muscular endurance, talking about what, like how fast they can recover and stuff like that, probably. I wonder if that also has anything to do with how quickly their muscles can get oxygenated and stuff like that. That's interesting. Okay, let's go on to the second one here. Researchers find that reading an op-ed was more likely to reinforce existing beliefs than to change the reader's mind. Yeah, but there's not enough detail here, Steve. Like an op-ed about an opposing view or not?
Right. In other words, the people did not move towards the view expressed in the op-ed. They actually went more in the direction of their pre-existing view.
Oh, wow, man. Does that...
Pick a topic. Do you support or oppose gun control? All right, read this op-ed. Did that move you in the direction of the op-ed, or did you just reinforce your pre-existing opinion?
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. I mean, then that really is singing the skeptic song right there, right? Like, yes, of course people do that. You know, this is a great thing to put in. Very tricky there, Steve, because you know that we're going to want to believe that because we know how people are. Okay, let me just go on to this last one here. Scientists have demonstrated quantum entanglement in the largest experimental setup to date. So this is basically saying that this is the farthest distance that they've ever had two particles somehow communicate with each other. 15 micrometers.
No, to clarify, it's not the greatest distance. It's the biggest thing.
Oh, it's the largest particles or whatever.
Yeah, this is with stuff that is itself 15 micrometers big.
Oh, my God. That's different.
Interesting.
Oh, my God. Did I sound like you there, Jay?
You did.
Oh, yeah.
I thought I was like in an echo
chamber. Scary. I thought, yeah.
What the hell, Kara? I don't know anything about micro entanglement in quantum 15s.
Come on. You think I do? Why are you talking to
I know,
me? Say this
I
to Bob.
I could talk to you about human hair. I don't
Do you know
I don't
about
believe
entangled
it.
Hair?
Steve, I don't think that there's 15 quantums. Okay, so this one's the fake.
What?
Okay. Okay.
I'm confused.
Evan?
Oh, great.
Let's go with it, Evan. Let's go with it.
Boy. All right. Untrained 8 to 12-year-old children. Untrained, right. So just your average old kids. The muscular endurance of elite marathon or triathlon athlete. I don't know what's going on here. I have a feeling, though, this one will be science, but I couldn't put my finger as to why. The second one about reading an op-ed more likely to reinforce existing beliefs than to change the reader's mind. Now, we touched on this earlier in the show to an extent, and we got, I think, some mixed results, depending on the medium. Was the conclusion there. More likely to reinforce existing beliefs. I don't know. Maybe if you're going through the action of reading the op-ed means you've already sort of opened your mind enough to accepting what else might be the opposite opinion. And if you've crossed that threshold or that hurdle, then maybe you do change your mind because you've already sort of taken the first big step to doing so by doing that. So that one could be the fiction. And the last one, quantum entanglement, largest experimental setup to date, 15 micrometers wide. Jay, you sufficiently confused me there. Thank you very much for that. So I have no idea what's going on with this one as well. I'm going to stray away from it, which leaves me back to the op-ed one. I'm going to have to say that one's going to be the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
See, the op-ed one seems like the most obvious science because it's the backfire effect, right? Like when you tell somebody one thing, then they just double down on the opposite thing. But the problem is, like, in what context, like you said, and like researchers find that, okay, in an N of 3, once they found this, cool. Researchers could have found anything.
Yeah, but you know I don't do that.
I know. But still, a lot of times there will be individual studies that have some sort of finding, and we don't know if it's been replicated. Yeah, we don't know if it's actually a trend. So could be anything. Researchers could have found that they reinforced it. They could have found that it helped them change their minds. I have to backburner that one. Now, I totally read the headline of number one, but did not read the article. It was definitely in my feed reader. I know. I definitely saw that there's something about kids being strong like bull, but I don't remember exactly what it said. So probably, this is going to screw me, but I'm going to say that it's science because it's on my radar. Sometimes that you do that on purpose and you play mind games.
Oh, yeah. I love to catch people who only read headlines.
Mm-hmm. But I'm going to say that if it's not science, it's because you've changed something. It's because they didn't have the endurance, but they had the recovery. Or they didn't have the endurance, but they had the muscle strength. But I don't know. Kids can run for a long time and never get tired. Like, it's amazing to watch kids run around and do things where I'm like, I am so tired just standing next to you. So I'm going to say that that's science. I'm going to say that the op-ed is science because that's a backfire effect situation. So by process of elimination, simply because I didn't even know that quantum entanglement had been experimentally shown at all. I thought that it was like purely kind of a theoretical construct.
Nope.
Whoa. Hold on, Bob. Control yourself.
But yeah, maybe it has been shown and maybe 15 micrometers is like some amazing thing. And I'm so out of this one. This is why Steve decided to have Bob go last, but I'm going to say that that's the fiction. Who else said that? Jay?
Jay said that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you, Jay.
Uh-oh.
All right. And Bob.
Let's see. Let's start with three. Yeah, the quantum entanglement. Yeah, it's been shown countless times.
That's a good sign.
In quantum systems, for sure. I mean, tiny, tiny quantum systems. This is huge to have something as crazy as entanglement showing up at the macro scale. I mean, you could see this pretty much with very sharp, unaided eyes.
This is macroscopic.
So this is a huge thing to be quantumly entangled. But of course, it'd have to be incredibly cold, near absolute zero. So that seems like a nice experiment and reasonable. I mean, yeah, I could buy it. It's still very tiny, and it's all about the experimental setup. Let's go to the first one, the untrained 8 to 12 year olds. I will admit that I read this goddamn thing. And
don't know the answer.
And I really had to do some thinking here because Steve, I will bet, read not just the one website. He probably read the original study, or read this very carefully.
So, no, he always reads the original study. He reads the original study of our stories when we report.
So I paid careful attention to this one when I was reading it, and I remember specific things. So I think he's trying to pull a fast one here. So I'm going to say that one is fiction. I won't go into too much detail because Steve will do it. But I could still be wrong because he's done that to me plenty of times where he read the original and he pulled out some subtlety that was just lacking in the quick overview that I read. So I'll say that one is fiction. I'll say obviously the second one is science because it just goes with everything that I know. The preponderance of stuff that I know goes more for that than against. So I'll say that's science, and the 12-year-olds are fiction. Although it's still surprising result.
So you guys are all spread out, so there's no reason not to take these in order. So we'll start with the first one. A new study finds that untrained 8 to 12-year-old children have the muscular endurance of elite marathon or triathlon athletes. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. I am looking at the actual original publication right now, and this one is absolutely science.
Whoa. Sorry, Bob.
Say what he did to me here.
So
now
they compared.
That really pisses me off.
They compared untrained adults to elite trained adults to untrained 8 to 12 year olds, and the 8 to 12 year olds and the elite trained adults pretty much were indistinguishable in terms of their endurance characteristics, and they were, of course, both groups were significantly better than the untrained adults. So they looked at multiple things. And it's, you know, in the actual study, it's described in technical jargon, but basically they looked at the oxygenation of the muscles. They looked at the endurance of the muscles. They looked at the recovery time of the muscles. And in all of those factors, the kids were just as good as the trained endurance athletes. In fact, their recovery was a little bit better than the adults.
I'm not surprised. They're little, like,
no, you're right, Kara.
They're machines.
Kids can go forever. I mean, it's amazing. And I think part of that is because kids are much less efficient than adults. They require more energy to cover the same distance because they're smaller. You know, they just have shorter stride. But they also don't move as efficiently as adults do.
Because they're clumsier?
So yeah, exactly. Okay. They're clumsier. They have their brains haven't fully myelinated yet. You know, they're just they don't have the experience. So trained athletes are going to move much more efficiently than a kid, you know, running on the playground. So maybe they need to be more efficient in order to keep up with adults because they need to have more endurance to keep up with adults because they don't have the efficiency of movement. But who knows? Or it could just be that they're young. Whatever. They're just just their protoplasm is.
So they don't really know why.
Okay. What is their you guys know this because you guys are parents, but how much do kids eat? Like, do they eat the same caloric intake? I know kids' meals are smaller than grown-ups' meals at, like, restaurants.
No, they eat relatively more.
That's what I figured, too. They probably actually
Brown adipose tissue.
Yeah. And from what I understand, I have two girls. From what I hear, boys eat even more.
Oh, yeah. Growing boys. That's like a –
Growing boys, right?
Yeah. Not in my house. My daughter eats more than my son does, and she's two, and he's
But your
five.
Daughter also likes to put her food on her head.
Yeah. So I taught her that. It's fine.
She also paints the wall with her poop, so.
I call it art. Active tissue is the brown fat.
It's short.
It's very metabolically active, and kids have a lot of it.
But like Julia, my older daughter, when she was doing swimming, you know, she was on season when she was swimming, she would eat like three times as much food as she normally does. Mm-hmm. She would eat more than I do, you know. Yeah. She would like down a pound of pasta like it would nothing.
That's amazing. And she's still skinny as a rail.
So
this one pisses me off.
The article
I read specifically, they were very specific. They said that the 8 to 12-year-olds beat the untrained adults in pretty much all categories. Fine. And then compared to the elite adults, they said that the kids had better recovery, quicker recovery than the adults, but they did not say anything about endurance.
They were equivalent in endurance.
Why wouldn't they have said that? That's big news. That one little component is big, and they left it out. And because of that, I lost.
So this is exactly why with studies like this, I have to track my way back to the original article, because I felt that the write arounds were missing. They were focusing on what they thought was the most dramatic part of the study, but it's actually not even mentioned in the abstract of the study itself, because it wasn't really a significant result. The results, the clear results were that there was no significant difference between the children and the trained adults. The fact that their recovery was a little bit better wasn't really even highlighted in the article itself. But the press release pulls out that. It's like, oh, they're better than it. Let's pull that out, even though that wasn't really the core finding of the study. The core findings of the study were on all of these different measures, they were indistinguishable from the trained adults.
That's amazing. That is so
It's
amazing,
amazing, but it also makes perfect sense to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems so reasonable.
But you could also think about it this way, that if you are in good shape, that you're youthful. You're in as good shape as a 12-year-old, you know?
Yeah, and think about all the parents who are like, oh, I just can't keep up with you. You know, it's like the kids are running off. They can't run as fast as their own kids.
All right, let's go on. Number two, researchers find.
So you're saying a kid can run.
Bob, let it go, man. Move on.
All right. All right.
Let's go on. Number two, researchers find that reading an op-ed was more likely to reinforce existing beliefs than to change the reader's mind. Who thought this was the fix? Just Evan.
I thought
Evan.
This was fiction.
So for the second week in a row, Evan, you are out on your own.
Oh, boy.
You won, Evan.
Yeah, I think it paid off.
Last week, it didn't pay off. You were the sole loser. And this week, you are the sole winner because this is the fiction.
I made it up.
Because the study showed the exact opposite, which is interesting.
That is interesting to me.
I don't know what to believe anymore.
Well, hang on, guys. I put this in because I really wanted to talk about this. So first of all, Kara, this was a researchers enrolled 3,567 people into this study.
Oh, that's good.
It was a nice size study. And they had participants read, the control group didn't read anything, but the participants read five op-eds. They had previously declared their opinions on these various topics. Then they had them read five different op-eds, and then they divided the participants into average people and people who were quote unquote elites, meaning that they were journalists, law professors, academics, think tank scholars, bankers, or congressional staffers. So people that you would think might have a little bit more of a developed opinion about these topics. Mm.
So the study found that for people in the control group, 50% of them agreed with the opinion expressed in the op-ed. But for the group that read the op-ed, 65 to 70% of them agreed with the opinion expressed in the op-ed. So that's a 10 to 15 point move in that direction. Or expressed another way, the people who read the op-ed, their opinion moved toward that expressed in the op-ed by 0.5 points on a 7-point scale, which they found to be highly significant. Moreover, this effect half of this effect persisted for 10 days and then leveled off and persisted unchanged between 10 days and 30 days. So there was a long-term effect here.
So there's kind of like almost a sensitive period after.
I mean, so people can be convinced by a well-argued opinion, by a good, solid argument. And I do, and that does make sense. And here's a couple of reasons why. First of all, as we have discussed on the show before, guys, and you should remember this, the backfire effect is overblown. It is way overblown. So first of all, there's contradictory research that shows that there isn't much of a backfire effect. And there was actually a recent, researchers recently tried to replicate the backfire effect and they couldn't. Couldn't even replicate it. And so the question is, how extensive is it? And it really may only, even in the studies that showed that it exists, it only exists for very emotionally held opinions and not for non-emotionally held opinions, right? So for most of the things that we believe where it's not part of our identity and not critical to our tribal identity, it's not part of our tribe, there is no backfire effect.
And the problem is that's the context we're usually talking about it. We're talking about like anti-vaxxers, flat earthers.
Yes.
That's a
right.
problem.
Exactly. But for most other things, no. And then even, the researchers were doubting like how significant it was. So that you have to really get really emotionally held opinions before it actually even kicks in, before the backfire effect is real. So it's actually a much more niche effect. It's a much smaller effect than was originally reported. Mm-hmm. So this is perfectly consistent with the research that shows that it's a niche effect. It's not a big effect. Most people were like, oh, okay, this is a good argument. Plus, the other thing is that why this study makes sense to me is because when you read an op-ed, it gives you the sense that you are now informed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So when you give people – and we've also discussed that before, that you can change people's mind, but you can't do it just by taking away their explanatory narrative. You have to give them an alternate explanatory narrative. And when you do that – and that's basically what an op-ed is doing, is it's giving people an alternate explanatory narrative backed by arguments and facts. And when you do that, people are persuaded.
And it does. Op-eds generally do appeal to emotion because they're opinion pieces. So they use anecdote really well. They tell stories really well.
I could see them being more
swaying than like a dry news article, for example. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. And op-eds have been very influential. I was surprised by this. Op-eds only really came into existence in 1970. I thought they were really much older than that.
What? Wow.
That's crazy. What? So the New York Times launched the first modern op-ed page, and op-ed stands for opposite the editorial page, right? Mm-hmm. So the op is an opinion. It's not opinion in editorial edition. It's the opposite the editorial page, just where it was physically in the newspaper. In 1970, September 21st, 1970, to promote discussion and learning, and then it really took off. And then people invest a lot of time and effort writing, op-eds. They could be real pieces of journalism in and of themselves. Yeah. And so well-written op-ed can have a lot of influence. And so this research supports that. It's actually a worthwhile investment. If you're running a nonprofit organization and you're an activist, you're trying to promote a certain point of view, writing persuasive op-eds is worth your time and effort. And this supports that. And I think that, and if you write it in such a way that you are giving people an explanatory narrative backed by facts, that is especially effective. And I have seen that at work myself. Like I've seen people flip their opinions on things, even people who are not generally skeptical, but it's like, oh yeah, I saw this, documentary where they gave me this narrative that explained this thing, and then I was persuaded by it, and they take on the opinion that was expressed in it. It could be very persuasive. The problem is when you buy too much into one op-ed, right, into one narrative, that's where there's a downside. I think that the effect is most profound when people read books, right? Like, for example, I've spoken with people who read books which were promoting a pseudoscientific point of view. Or Jay, you had this experience, you know, famously when you saw Loose Change, right? You watch a 2-hour documentary. It gives you this explanation for something complicated backed by a lot of facts, and it's really persuasive. You in fact, if anything, you have to fight against being persuaded by these sorts of things because
they're really good at it.
Because you have to say, okay, what's the other side saying? What are people who disagree with this point of view saying, and why do they disagree? And who you have to work through the back and forth until you decide who has the most persuasive position. When you think about it, it's actually people listening to op-eds and being persuaded about them could be more of a problem. Because people get too persuaded by one point of view rather than more of a thorough process.
Well, and you hear it all the time. It's almost like a common trope in a lot of stand-up comedians, how like the last thing I read was like the truest thing I ever read. It's just like constantly, oh, and then I read a new thing. Like my whole life has been opened up.
Exactly.
I've completely changed my mind. It's like, it does happen to a lot of people.
So let's go on. Number 3, scientists have demonstrated quantum entanglement within the largest experimental setup to date, 15 micrometers wide, or micrometers, whatever you prefer. The thickness of a fine human hair, that is science. And so the scientists are always pushing for the biggest thing that they can quantumly entangle, or they could demonstrate any kind of quantum effect. And whenever we get to that biggest thing, they're still tiny, but we're getting to macroscopic levels. But Bob is correct. These are very, very contrived, carefully controlled setups. This required an experimental setup at -273°C. Yeah, so near absolute zero, because you got to cancel out all of the noise, because that noise of temperature, in the background will completely cause decoherence. And what they did in this case is they used these vibrating drums, and then they were able to get them to vibrate in synchrony with each other, and that was able to entangle them. And the drums themselves were 15 micrometers big.
Oh, wow.
But that was basically the setup. But it had the usual stuff with that very, very cold, zero noise environment to get it to work. So Bob sniffed this one out. All right, so good work, Evan.
Hey, thanks.
You followed up your solo loss with a solo win. Good job.
Yes.
Proud of you, Ev.
Nice and even. I like it.
All right.
So this week's quote was suggested by listener Carl Mayer.
Carl!
From Colorado. Thank you, Carl. We like this quote. Anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge. And that was Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, so that's from 1980, before the interwebs. It's, I think, all the more true today, if anything. But it's constant. It's true. It's not a new phenomenon.
Right.
So it's
timeless.
And I think we've said this quote on the show before, but that's okay. It's a good enough one that we could use it again.
I agree. And it's germane, of course.
Yeah. And this has been said in a lot of other ways, too. I like the Speaker of the House who said, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
Yeah.
Tip O'Neill,
yeah. And there was actually, I just saw, that reminds me of a study I just saw that showed that people will readily interpret opinions that agree with their opinions as if they were facts. That we file them away as facts, even if they're opinions, if they agree with us. Which of course was nicely satirized in that Pixar movie about the brain. What was that movie called?
Inside Out.
Inside Out. Remember, they got their facts and their opinions all mixed up. Like, that happens all the time.
It's true.
Is that movie good? Should I see it?
Oh, yeah.
It's cute. Pixar, right. So the answer is yes.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
We love you, Steve. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions.
dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.